Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we will be speaking with Ann Hillerman, Hampton Sides, and Doug Preston about the upcoming Tony Hillerman Writers Conference. And we will be talking to Carol Norton from Wild Earth Guardians about the People's Forum on Public Lands Trapping. Right now, I'm very happy to welcome to the show Mary Jo McConaughey. She is a journalist who has worked for the Los Angeles Times, Rolling Stone, Time, Newsweek, many other newspapers and magazines. And her new book is called Maya Rhodes, One Woman's Journey Among the People of the Rainforest. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Now, you've got a bunch of events coming up. Today at noon, you'll be at the Ottawa Station Bookstore in Los Alamos. And Thursday at 7 in the evening, you'll be at Bookworks in Albuquerque. And then you'll be back here in Santa Fe on Saturday at 2 at the Museum of Indian Arts and Culture. This is a book that starts out when you were... a young woman, a young journalist, and you end up in the rainforest near the border of Mexico and Guatemala. How did you land there? What drew you to that place?
In fact, I wasn't yet a journalist. I was simply a young woman traveling around, and I went into the Museum of Anthropology in Mexico City, which is a wondrous place, with my sister on vacation, and discovered these dioramas of the Lacandon indigenous people, who are Maya, in the rainforest of southern Mexico. There are very few of them remaining, and they still wear the ancient clothes, wear their hair long. The women wear dead birds in their hair. It's really quite beautiful. But I was just enchanted, and being a young woman and not having a career yet, I said, I think I'll just go there. My sister left, and so I started out alone, and eventually, maybe a month later, was able to visit with these people in the jungle.
And that was an experience that, well, let's say most Westerners do not have, to say the least, because you basically had to find your own way there with very little guidance. And the only thing you were told is bring gifts and bring some fireworks so they know you're there.
That's right. Little guidance, no roads. It was quite exciting. And I did find a gentleman called an archaeoastronomer. I'd never heard of that occupation before, but it's someone who looks at the sky in connection to the ancient peoples. And he was the one that suggested I take the firecrackers. And he said, if you make your way to the edge of this lake, they will come over for you if they want to, after you set off the firecrackers. And indeed they did. And that was the beginning of the journey, and I was enchanted. I have been enchanted with the Maya ever since.
So you weren't there and you weren't with them for all that long. Then you went into your career. How did you end up back in that part of the world?
When I left that rainforest, I became a journalist. I went to the Middle East. I was working for an English language newspaper there, and after a few years came back to the States and started working in Central America. All of that time, I was reading. I was sort of an aficionado of the Maya, and I just read and read and read, a total amateur, of course, and tried to see anything I could that was connected with them. You know, there are a lot of Mayanists, quote-unquote, a lot of people fascinated by the Maya who do this kind of thing. It's not all professionals, even though some of the smartest people in the world are Mayanists. At any rate, I began covering the wars in Central America, in El Salvador, Nicaragua, Guatemala, and the invasion of Panama. And when they died down somewhat in the 90s, the armies were shrinking, it was less of a story for the United States. And I said, you know, I'm going to go back. I'm going to go back. It's been on my mind all this time. I'm going to go back to the rainforest. And for the next few years, that's exactly what I did.
And where did you go? How did you decide where you were going to go? And what did you do when you got there?
The first trips I made were in order to find out about the ancient places, to visit the old cities, more or less what a tourist might do. Going to places you may have heard of, Palenque, Tikal, Uxmal, Xibalchaltun. These are wonderful places that are very well set up for tourism and welcome tourists. And then, of course, I started going to smaller places, and eventually I found out that this particular archaeologist was intent on finding out one of archaeology's big secrets, that is, solving one of their big secrets. What happened around the year 800, 900 to the Maya that caused them to abandon these beautiful rainforest cities?
Has that mystery ever been solved?
In the book, I suggest a solution because of staying around with this one archaeologist at his dig. This place was called Dos Pilas. It means two fountains of water there in the middle of the desert. It's a huge site, and it's a place where it had the old-fashioned kind of expeditionary geographers, all kinds of scientists, cavers, and of course epigraphers, people who make out the codes written on the stelae. And it was a thrill to be sort of taken along and being a fly on the wall or a fly on a tree, whatever you want to say. And several landmark discoveries were made at Dos Pilas. And the chapter in the book that talks about it has some very, shall we say, idiosyncratic characters in it. The kind that you do find out in the middle of nowhere, trying to figure out this and that about what happened 1,200 years ago. Now you ask, has that mystery been solved? I can say yes, many different ways. However, perhaps there is not one single cause.
Right.
You can see in the book my sense that it's overwhelming greed on the part of men and women. And
which is, it's always amazing when you look back hundreds, thousands of years and see the same human patterns of civilization that we bemoan right now.
You're absolutely right. And that's why I found the discussion about the quote-unquote disappearance of the Maya so fascinating. Of course, we know the Maya didn't disappear. So much of this book is about the Maya today.
Right.
There are 8 million of them speaking 26 languages, and 15% of them are in the United States. But with regard to the disappearance, the environment was very degraded by the time they were stopping building their rainforest places. But mostly they were making war in a way that involved ordinary people, that is, civilians. And why? Because they wanted the equivalent of oil in those days, you know, trade routes that would get them certain luxury goods and certain things they felt they needed. That is, the most elite of them needed. And once they started spreading war so that it was just constant, much like it is, if you ask me today, that it is just one after another, the society could not withstand that anymore.
Then you cut forward to the present and you have some of the things that you describe in the book, CIA interventions, the destruction of cooperatives by armies and paramilitaries and so on, and it's the same thing all over again. I mean, you have contemporary greed that is enforced by corporations, military, and government being perpetrated on these people who are now actually living fairly quiet, non imperialist lives in the rainforest.
Right, non-intrusive. They're just leading their own lives. And Guatemala, for instance, had 10 years of democratic elections after the Second World War, using us as a model, admiring Roosevelt. And those were the first free and fair elections they'd had, according to our U.S. State Department. But in fact, the president, right about the early 50s, ran afoul of the CIA and of a major, major United States company, the United Fruit Company. And this is well known and well documented in some beautiful books. And CIA is the one which organized it, called it Operation Success, in fact. And it was used often after that, right down to the time of the 1989 invasion of Panama, where I reported elements of Operation Success from 1954 were used in that operation. So the Maya have undergone many of these incursions from the outside. These are just the latest.
What did they do in Operation Success, quote-unquote?
What they did was spread a certain kind of propaganda. Some of it is called black ops, some gray ops, that spread lies that the people who were very Catholic, for instance, were going to be prevented from having many children. Flyers were made and dropped from aircraft, warning them that an army was right at the edge of the city, for instance, and about to destroy the place. It spread fear. It had a radio station that was spreading these kind of rumors. It's fascinating because then in 89, when we were going into the north, because the south was already aflame, the people who were listening to the radio were hearing that we had already sort of conquered Panama and Noriega. And one of the journalists, there were several of us going in, said, wait a minute, remember Operation Success? And she looked at the dial, and it was the same dial that the Contras, whom the CIA supported in Nicaragua, used as their radio station. These are patterns that began in 54 with Guatemala, for instance, and continue on. The insurrections among the Indians never stopped. The one in Chiapas, the Zapatista insurrection, is one in a line of many. It's not as if the Indians have yet been fully conquered. They lead their own lives with their own cosmology. They still keep the calendar that's 3,000 years old.
We're talking to Mary Jo McConaughey about her memoir, Maya Roads, One Woman's Journey Among the People of the Rainforest. Let's talk about that for a moment. How do the Mayan people whom you met view their own calendar, which of course has become this big sort of crazy New Age phenomenon in our time and place?
Indeed, in 2012, there are celestial events, as they call them. The astronomers have said certain things are going to happen, and in fact, some of the Maya sort of quote-unquote predicted them. That is, they spoke to them. And when you say using the calendar, in fact, the Maya use three calendars and always have. Without getting too technical, one is very much like ours. That is, it's about the same number of days, and it's about the agricultural round. The other is a 260-day year, and that's very important for the spiritual guides to whom you might go to know what your purpose in life is, for instance. That's very important. The one that is causing quite a bit of stir right now is the 5,126-year calendar, the last year of which is next year.
Right.
And there's quite a bit of discussion, even among the spiritual guides right now, about the meaning of it. One of the spiritual guides told me, these are like priests, but not exactly like our priests or ministers, but they are people who study the calendar and who dedicate themselves to this cosmology. And in my opinion, much was lost over these hundreds of years. You know, genocide is not just about killing individuals, it's about killing the culture. And there have been incidents of genocide in which much was lost. And I think the spiritual guides, when they say they are meeting now together to understand the meaning of next year, maybe partly because of these, the way that we from the outside have treated them. That had it not been that way, perhaps they'd have more. I mean, this is speculation, it's something journalists don't do, but imagine if their culture hadn't been attempted to be destroyed all these times, how much more we'd all be benefiting. So they will tell you they don't know exactly what's going to happen on December 21st, 2012. But they say, why is everyone asking what's going to happen that day? Instead of asking, what can we be doing now to be saving Madre Tierra, Mother Earth? Because it's our responsibility. They, Maya believe, you know, Maya people believe that the successful creation of people in the Popol Vuh, which is sort of like their Bible, came when the gods were able to create beings who could praise them and understand where they came from and understand their responsibility about the earth. In the Popol Vuh, several attempts at creating people didn't work too well. Some ended up monkeys, some ended up wooden mannequins, because they couldn't verbalize and they couldn't talk about the earth. So it's a time that the Maya spiritual guides are thinking, this is it. We really need to be thinking about what we're doing as human beings.
There's a poignant passage in your book where you talk about, I mean, having witnessed both war and the after effects of war and uncovering massacres and seeing what military interventions have done to people and seeing people's spirits be broken and all of that, there's a very lovely passage where you talk about preventing war and doing this for the sake of your daughter.
You see, it just seems to me that once you start, there's no control. That first characterization of a people as the enemy, as terrorists, as people who don't have our values, is the beginning of something over which no one has control. It's unpredictable. The most egregious crimes come out of it. I just want her to know that you need to start before the beginning, because once it started, in a way, it's certainly too late for a lot of people. The once you've been through a war, once you've lost your son or daughter, you go the rest of your life saying, why couldn't I protect them? And it's not your war, but you're the one that's going to have the after effects, not to mention the young people that have died. So, yes, I was thinking about that a lot, and I do write about it, because it's reflection always, you know. I mean, a journalist doesn't reflect on what she sees or he sees in the journalism, but a book allows you to do it.
You said in the very first chapter, which is a beautiful description of your first meeting with the Lacandon Maya people, that if you had known what was going to happen to their place and to the rainforest, you would have observed more closely and taken more notes. What has happened to this area that you first went to?
Very much of it has been destroyed by greed, once more, of certain elites who were able to make pacts with certain Lacandon and destroy much of it for timber. Very, very wealthy part of the world, because it's all of this hardwood. You know, it's what helps us continue to breathe, because it soaks up the carbon. I mean, it's our lung in this hemisphere besides the Amazon. but more of it goes each year. There's downright corruption, which allows thievery to take place. And the war itself, that is the Zapatista War, did not affect it. But because there is such poverty, institutional lack of opportunity, generation after generation, to better their lives, people have come into the rainforest to cut it down and plant corn, plant food for themselves. And that's an endless circle too, because this is not proper earth for this kind of planting, and it won't last very long. So they just have to keep moving and cutting down trees.
And yet, when you talk about the Lacandon Maya people whom you met at the beginning, and indeed other people who are still there, poverty is not really a word that you would use. People are living sustainably, and I'm sick of that word, but there there we have it, in relation to the land around them.
A small number of people are, but what happens is that the roads are built by the timber companies, the roads are built by the oil companies, the roads are built by tourism companies, and then others come in. And, I mean, these are people that are impoverished without the knowledge of the rainforest. The people who live, like, for instance, those few bands of Lacandonas lived for hundreds of years, and many other indigenous people live, have knowledge, priceless knowledge, with regard to medicine, food, sustenance, beauty. And those who come in plant a different way. You know, I really don't want to blame the poor who come in. It's because every time they have tried to get a leg up, so many of these people, they've been shut down by an elite who, to me, is greedy, wants money, land, beyond what is sufficient to live. And so those, especially indigenous, who don't have status in the society, suffer. And also, when you have 400 villages destroyed in Guatemala, for instance, this is by the army's own accounting, 400 villages, where do they go?
Right. The book is called Maya Roads, One Woman's Journey Among the People of the Rainforest. And lest you think it's all war and destruction, there's a lot of beauty and just a lot of personal memoir.
It's a lot of fun.
And a lot of fun in this book, it's true. Mary Jo McConaughey is the author, and she is going to be at the Ottawa Station Bookstore in Los Alamos today at noon, and then on Thursday at 7 in the evening at Bookworks in Albuquerque, and Saturday at 2 in the afternoon in Santa Fe at the Museum of Indian Arts and Culture. And that last one is free with museum admission. The other two are free and open to the public. Mary Jo, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
We're going to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'm happy now to welcome to the program authors Doug Preston, Hampton Sides, and Anne Hillerman. They are all taking part in the 2011 Tony Hillerman Writers Conference, which is happening this November 10th through 12th. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
Anne, tell us what this conference is all about.
We started the conference, I guess, about 10 years ago in honor of my dad, who was the mystery writer Tony Hillerman. And we also, in addition to the conference, we set up a couple prizes to honor Dad. But the main point of the conference was to celebrate New Mexico authors and to just kind of shine the light on people, both people who were writing mysteries sort of in my dad's tradition, and also nonfiction writers, because, as you know, my dad had started out as a journalist.
And we have here people who are both fiction and nonfiction writers. I guess everybody. Although Hampton, have you written fiction yourself?
I tried once, and my editor told me to take a hike. Pretty much, so I'm sticking with nonfiction.
Now, Doug Preston, you are both a journalist, a fiction writer, and a nonfiction writer. The latest book that I've been reading of yours is called *The Monster of Florence*, which we will be talking about in a few weeks in more detail on this program. But I wanted to ask you, what are the differences between writing a story like The Monster of Florence, which is a true nonfiction crime story, and writing a fiction crime story?
Well, when you're writing nonfiction, you have the unpleasant duty to tell the truth. And sometimes the truth is very messy, and it's hard to make it into a good story, but you really don't have the option of rearranging things. So it's funny, when I'm writing nonfiction, I keep thinking, gosh, I wish I were writing a novel. And then when I'm writing a novel, I think, oh, I wish I were writing nonfiction so I could have some kind of structure here. So they're both difficult in their own ways.
Hampton, what about you? You write long-form nonfiction, Hellhound on His Trail, which was about the assassination of Martin Luther King, the latest book that you and I have talked about a couple of times. You use the techniques of fiction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that narrative nonfiction really strives to do a lot of the things fiction does, in the sense of looking for a story arc that is pleasing, developing characters, trying to figure out the pacing so that it is a pleasurable experience to sit down and read. A lot of the techniques of fiction go directly into the best narrative nonfiction. The only difference is that part that Doug was talking about. You can't make anything up. And I find that it is an unpleasant duty sometimes, but it's also true that when you get a hold of the right kind of story, the truth is much more interesting than fiction, and also more compelling because you know it's true, because it happened, because it could happen again, perhaps. There's definitely a lot of crossover and sort of the membrane between fiction and nonfiction is not, let's say it's semi-permeable. You know, it goes right back and forth.
Now, Anne, you are perhaps following in your father's footsteps. You're working on a novel now, having done more nonfiction in the past.
Oh, my gosh. And it gives me tremendous appreciation for people like Doug who can write fiction. I think I underestimated how difficult it is to keep all the characters and plot ideas in your head, but I'm having a good time with it. It's really stretching me. And I have a couple nonfiction projects on the back burner, and I'm telling myself I'm going to give this novel till the end of the year, and then I'm going to get back to what I know how to do better, which is the nonfiction. One reason we were so glad to have Doug and Hampton come to our conference is that we always get people who are wanting to make the transition from nonfiction to fiction. And we thought both of them would have such really great insights in terms of how you tell a story, whether it's fiction or nonfiction. As Hampton was saying, basically the elements are the same.
Right.
Hellhound on His Trail was one of the most gripping stories I've ever read, and it was just incredible. I mean, it's an amazing book, but what really impressed me was that he was able to make it even more gripping than a fictional story like it. I mean, it was just amazing, and I'm surprised to have Hampton say that he had trouble writing fiction, because I thought that, you know, he uses the techniques of fiction so well in nonfiction. I think he'd write a great novel.
Well, I'll probably give it a try one of these days when money isn't such an issue, you know, raising three kids and putting them through college and all that. I definitely do want to try my hand at it later on, because, like, as we've said, and I think we're saying it in multiple different ways, is many of the disciplines are the same. They're completely different creatures.
Right. Now, let's talk for a moment about the conference. It's happening November 10th through 12th, and a bunch of people will be there. Sandy Ault, who is a mystery writer, we have her on every time she comes out with a new book, which is every year or two. And let's see, David Morrell will be there, and Doug Preston and Hampton Sides. What actually happens during these 3 days of the conference?
Well, we're going to start with a pre-conference workshop with Sandy, which is going to be a lot of hands-on writing. People will not only get to listen, but actually try their hand at the new skills that she's teaching and then read it to each other. And then on Saturday, we're focusing on the craft of writing. We're going to have novelist Joanne Mapson, who lives in Santa Fe, who is very well regarded both as a teacher and as sort of a guru of women's fiction, is going to talk to us at breakfast. And then Doug is going to talk to us about just techniques you can use. I think what you were saying about pacing, Hampton, how to keep the story moving. And then we're going to, then Hampton's going to talk to us about the art and craft of narrative nonfiction. This is all on Friday. And then we're going to have a couple panels, one about how to create good bad guys. And we're having both fiction people and nonfiction people on that panel, because good villains are what makes good stories work. Rather they're, I mean, the way Hampton, the wonderful job he did in Hellhound on His Trail of sort of... focusing on the traits that make that character so compelling, or if it's a bad guy that David Morrell is inventing. And then the next day we're going to talk about the business of writing.
Ah, yes, which is very important and changing as publishing changes, and we could talk about that to the end of time. But let's go back to this question of good bad guys. Doug Preston, when you're creating a villain, how do you do it?
Well, I think actually... a really good villain in fiction is almost more important than having a really good guy or you know, protagonist. The villain has to be three-dimensional. The villain can't be completely evil. He or she has to have some good qualities. Otherwise, they aren't as scary. But a person who has some good qualities who is also really horribly evil and psychotic is a lot more frightening than just someone who's a one-dimensional bad person. You know, Hellhound on His Trail had a villain who was absolutely horrifying in almost every way, except that you get so close to him that you start feeling this sickening sense of partial identification with him. I mean, you can just see into his mind enough to see that he's not 100% bad. He's 99% bad, and there's that 1% that is you know, makes him a real human being.
Right, and I think, I mean, when you say that the ones who are multidimensional are scary, I guess that's because they're more like us in a way, and but for the grace of God, there go we.
Exactly. I mean, I think one of the great failed characters in Shakespeare was Iago, because you never quite understand why he is the way he is. He seems perfectly evil in every way. And, I mean, maybe the Shakespearean scholars are going to kill me for that. But I do think that you have to understand a person's motivation. Most people do evil thinking they're doing something right, that they're doing something good. And that makes it all the scarier.
That's a great point.
Yeah.
What draws you, and this is something we could ask to all of you, or to really to any mystery writer, any person who does a murder mystery, is what draws you to actually wanting to explore the psyche of somebody who in real life you really probably would not want to know?
Well, I guess I'm... Well, there's something about human evil that is very... that is ineffable. It's almost fundamentally incomprehensible. I mean, when you look at horrific evil, like the person who assassinated Martin Luther King Jr., it makes you wonder, how could someone do that? What is the psychological dynamic inside that person's head? And that fascinates me. I do think it tells us something about human nature that's universal, and that's what, you know, my thrillers explore, and also what my nonfiction has explored, and Hampton's book also explores the same thing.
I was going to say, and the monster of evil, I mean, the monster of Florence is someone that you explored and tried to even identify this guy. You obviously came to understand a little bit about the workings of this criminal in Florence.
Yeah, that's a character, and again, we're going to talk about the book in more detail, but just to give people a teaser about it, this book, The Monster of Florence, you, Doug Preston, went to Florence hoping to... live happily in this beautiful Italian city and write a murder mystery that involved a Renaissance painting, and instead you came across a much more compelling actual mystery, namely a killer who would kill young lovers in their cars in the Italian countryside around Florence, and you became part of this drama yourself, which is also, I mean, I was reading the part about where the detectives called you in, sweating bullets. I can't even imagine how you felt.
Well, I felt like I'd fallen into one of my novels. It was so strange. You know, as a journalist, you have a distance from your subject. And it was awful. One day I was just walking through the streets of Florence, and the police called me on my cell phone, and they said, "Where are you? We are coming to get you right now." And that began this nightmare where I fell into my own story. And suddenly it wasn't just a journalist, you know, with the proper distance from his subject, but all of a sudden I was being interrogated and being accused of being an accessory to murder, of knowing the monster of Florence, of protecting him, of being involved in trying to frame an innocent person for being the monster of Florence. It was the craziest experience of my life.
Hampton, what about you? I mean, you write books about people who are also, well, I mean, James Earl Ray, but also Blood and Thunder. I mean, Kit Carson, not everybody's hero.
Mm-hmm. Well, in Kit Carson's case, I think you had a person who was sort of the villain and the hero, the protagonist and the antagonist, all in one person. The contradictions of his personality were so enormous. In certain circles, in certain terms, he was a hero. In other circles, especially in Navajo circles, he is considered a genocidal maniac. And that dichotomy was fascinating to me, and it's one of the kinds of tension that I think drives that book. It's like, what is he going to do next? He's capable of this extraordinary violence, and is a creature of a world that I don't fully understand. I don't think any of us understand exactly how violent it was to be alive in New Mexico in the 1800s. Sometimes it's not so simple. Creating a bad guy and then a good guy, it might be the same person all wrapped into one personality.
And when I think of that Blood and Thunder book, I imagine you with like a room full of other research on Kit Carson and having to go through all of that and decide which of those details would fit in your book. I think that must have been such a challenge, and you handled it magnificently.
Well, thanks. I mean, I do find that that the research, although it's really the hardest part of doing these narrative histories, it's also the most fun because, let's just be honest, at least for me and for most writers, writing a first draft is really hard work. And I tend to want to put that off until the very last minute. And perhaps it's a form of avoidance behavior or, you know, procrastination, but I will research a book probably to the point where it's literally the 11th hour. So I have to write my books really fast. But it's, like I say, the research and traveling to these places and getting to know the physical landscapes that these people walked on and among, you know, this is the joy of doing nonfiction. It's the fun part.
Yeah. And I think in good fiction, too, that same kind of research in Doug's books, mm-hmm. I mean, feeling like you are at the scene.
Right.
Makes the stories come alive.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think good nonfiction has to make landscape a character almost. At least I tend to do that. New Mexico and the landscape around the Four Corners is very much emerges, I think, as a character in this story of Blood and Thunder. And with Hellhound, I definitely tried to capture the atmosphere of Memphis, my hometown, where I was born and raised, and tried to turn that into a character in a sense that you both love and hate. You know, it's not necessarily a beautiful place or majestic scenery. It's somehow trying to find the details that make a place come alive on the page.
Yeah.
Now, Doug Preston, when you are starting to write a thriller or a mystery or murder mystery, how do you begin your research as opposed to a nonfiction book? How do you research a novel?
Well, a lot of my fictional books began as nonfiction. I, you know, used to write for the New Yorker magazine and other magazines, and often in writing an article, I would think, "Gee, this would make a great novel," and then it would, you know, eventually become a novel. And it's interesting, you know, getting back to Tony Hillerman, who's one of my favorite mystery writers. I don't think he could have written his books if he hadn't started out as a journalist. I mean, his details are so beautifully observed in his novels. His sense of character, his sense of place, his knowledge of New Mexico, and all that, you know, came from him being a journalist. That's what made him one of the things that made him such a wonderful fiction writer. And so I do think, you know, to all those people who are writing nonfiction, who want to move into fiction, I would say they've got a great advantage over those people who just want to start as fiction writers. I really think that, the eye of a journalist, the ability to interview people, the ability to research, the ability to pick out all those little details among the welter of the overwhelming tidal wave of information that comes into you as a journalist, you've got to pick out just a few things, all lend themselves to writing fiction.
Ann Hillerman, are your father's books, they certainly must be influential because I'm assuming you were reading them as he was writing them when you were young. Is that true?
Well, his first one didn't come out until I was in college, so I didn't really have a chance to read them when I was younger than that. But yeah, I always love them. I think, adding to what Doug was saying about how writing nonfiction helps with fiction, my dad spent about 20 years as a reporter, which meant lots of endless city council, county commission, school board meetings. So he listened to a lot of different people talking. And I think that really helps when it comes to writing dialogue.
Absolutely. Now, do you want to talk about what your novel is about, or is that secret until you're done?
Well, I'll tell you a little bit. My dad, as you know, had all these Navajo police detectives who were his characters.
Right.
And he had one character, Bernadette Manuelito, and he never did much with her. She was always sort of the sweet little girl sidekick, and then she married Jim Chi. And that just kind of bothered my feminist roots. I thought this officer needs to at least have one book where she is not rescued by Jim Chi, but where she solves the crime, where she is the hero, and maybe let her husband do a little supporting. And I'm having a lot of fun with it. I have to say, I feel like these characters are sort of my family.
I know. Well, there's this thing that happens. It happened more when I was a kid, but I would read a lot of novels when I was young, and when the book was closed, I missed them.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. Yeah. I feel sort of like Chi and Leaphorn were my uncles.
Exactly. So, we are talking about the upcoming Tony Hillerman, it's called the Tony Hillerman Writers Conference. It's November 10th through 12th of this year. Now, who's the conference for? Aspiring writers, experienced writers?
There's a little something there for everybody. Most of our students tend to be people who aren't just rank beginners. Maybe they're people who've worked in a corporate situation and they've done a lot of writing, but not writing from their own hearts. Writing that they've made their living as writers, but so now they'd like to write something for themselves.
Right.
And then some are people who have been working on fiction maybe pretty successfully. Maybe they've self-published or they've had little publishers buy their books, and they want to move on to the next level. They want to really be able to support themselves as writers. So they come to these conferences with specific agendas of not only getting the information that we offer, but also making contacts with other writers who have ideas for them and with our faculty people. The thing that we like about our conference is that it's a small conference. Usually we have less than 100 people. So people have a really wonderful opportunity to interact with each other and to get to know our faculty.
If people want to find out more about the conference, they can go to wordharvest.com. And is there a telephone number locally that people can call?
Sure. It's 505-471-1565.
And people can learn not only techniques of writing along the lines that we've been speaking, but also the business of writing, which is a whole other show, which we will have to do at another time, but also a very important part of it.
Right. We have a lot of information on our website and also on our Facebook page.
Wordharvest.com. Ann Hillerman, Doug Preston, and Hampton Sides, thank you all so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'm glad now to welcome back to the show Carol Norton. She's the Associate Director of Wild Earth Guardians. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, Mary Charlotte.
It's good to have you here. Now, you are here to tell us very briefly in the time that we have left about the People's Forum on Public Lands Trapping. What is going on?
Well, what's happened is that the New Mexico Game Commission, mostly appointed by Martinez, our governor, has decided that trapping is okay in New Mexico, despite the fact that most New Mexicans don't think it's okay at all. And by trapping, I mean using steel leg hold, bone crushing traps that are put out to capture animals like coyotes, lynx, bobcats, fox.
And so this whole issue of trapping came to, we did a show on it over the summer, and it really came to the fore this summer when I think tens of thousands of people signed petitions against trapping, and they didn't really get their hearing.
That's exactly right. 12,000 people is what one of the commissioners themselves said. And they, what happened was the Game Commission scheduled their meeting to be in Clayton, New Mexico, which most people know is pretty hard to get to. It was during the week, and we just knew that we weren't going to be represented in the proportion that we believe New Mexicans believe in reducing trapping. So we wanted to give people an opportunity to speak their piece. And so we're going to have this trapping forum in Albuquerque on Wednesday.
And so this is tomorrow, September 14th, from 5:30 to 8:30 in Albuquerque at the Wool Warehouse at 516 First Street Northeast. So what's going to happen there?
It's going to be really interesting, I think. We've asked a number of panelists to come together and consider testimony from people in the audience. People will have an opportunity to say their piece, say what they believe about trapping and whether it should exist in New Mexico. The panel, which is representing churches, education, representatives to our state government, will then deliberate and decide whether what they've heard makes sense and render a decision that will be sent to the Game Commission. And we'll be videotaping as well as recording, and we'll also be able to send all of the testimony to the Game Commission.
Will this, for those who can't go to Albuquerque, I mean, much less Clayton, will this videotaping be on the web?
We'll post parts of it for sure, the parts that are most interesting. And really, what we want to do more than anything is kick off our legislative campaign. So we're clear that the Game Commission is not going to change their mind. Not only did they remove the trap ban that had been in place under Governor Richardson, they increased the amount of lands where trapping is allowed. So they're very pro-trapping commission at the being mostly responsive to extractive industries. And
why are extractive industries interested in trapping?
Well, it depends what you call an extractive industry, but we believe that when you trap an animal for its fur and then sell it, that you're actually extracting a resource the natural world.
Right.
So we call it an extractive industry. It's a very small number of people participate in it, and we just believe it's cruel, inhumane, and unnecessary. So we'll be working for the next year and a half, possibly 3 to 4 years, on getting a bill passed through our legislature, which is much more open to the idea of banning traps on New Mexico public lands.
If people want to find out more, they can go to wildearthguardians.org. They can also go to trapfreenm.org. And anything else you want to let us know about?
You know, we're collaborating with a number of organizations, including Animal Protection of New Mexico, Sierra Club, Born Free. There's a couple of others. You'll find them on our website. And we just really appreciate all the work that everybody's put into this. And we look forward to a future where we don't have, where lynx and coyotes and beautiful animals with beautiful furry coats can run free.
Not to mention wolves.
Not to mention wolves. 14 wolves caught in traps in the last 10 years.
Carol Norton from Wild Earth Guardians, thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.